I'm David Boeri, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, with Barry Bonds on the verge of breaking baseball's hallowed home run record, an argument for banning the long ball. But first, the Bush administration says that it's not changing the timetable for assessing progress in Iraq, despite statements from a top general that a real judgment on the troop surge might not be possible until November. The much-anticipated report from Iraq is due before that in mid-September. After meeting with veterans and military families today, the president called on Congress to pass his war funding bill. Rick Klein.
It's a comprehensive spending request that Congress has failed to act on. Instead, the Democratic leaders chose to have a political debate on a precipitous withdrawal of our troops from Iraq. The House and Senate are now scheduled to leave for their August recess before passing a bill to support our troops and their missions.
That's President Bush this morning. Rick Klein is senior political analyst for ABC News, and he joins us now. And Rick, to that political debate the president has criticized, the headline on your column, The Note, today is Playing Hardball. Is that what both sides are doing here?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting couple of days. The hardball from the Senate side, and the Democratic leader, Harry Reid, kept the Senate in overnight against Republican objections to highlight the fact that Republicans were blocking a straight vote on whether there should be troop withdrawal. Now we're seeing the president making his point today. He also, his Defense Department sent a letter yesterday to Senator Hillary Clinton responding to a letter that she had written 2 months ago. And this one basically accusing her of feeding enemy propaganda by suggesting that the administration start planning for a troop withdrawal. I think it was very much a planned strategy to make this a personal debate, to take it directly at Democrats, and to try to rally the base that's really quite sour on this war at this point, but trying to rally them against Democrats from the president's perspective.
So if anything, it seems the partisanship is only escalating.
That's right. I don't think there's any sign of that going away, although I do think that from the perspective of Congress at this point, they're pretty pleased with just letting things linger for a little while. They realize they don't have the votes. They don't have the prospect for having the votes in the immediate future, but they want to wait this out. As Bill Clinton said in an interview yesterday, September is coming up, and that's going to be the key moment. There's a big report in the middle of September that's going to look at the progress on this. They'll have 2 more months to judge whether the troop surge has worked, and that'll be the time that Democrats are banking on a lot of Republicans having changed their minds because they're getting pressure from back home.
So some Republicans are joining Democrats now and questioning whether the Pentagon is even ready for a troop withdrawal. It does make one wonder, when the president keeps calling for bipartisanship, why he does that when the call for withdrawal has become bipartisan.
Yes, that's true. I mean, when he calls for bipartisanship on supporting his strategy. He isn't looking to budge on his strategy at all. He thinks it's working. He says it's working. His people say it's working. But there's been a couple of incidents in just in the last few days that I thought really illuminated some other possible breaks even within the administration. I think the admission yesterday by Ambassador Crocker that essentially U.S. troops are paying with their lives to buy time for the Iraqis to make a political reconciliation, that is a very stark admission that we don't hear often from the mouth of the administration. Some people are calling it a gaffe. If it's just the truth, then it's something that more Republicans are likely to join Democrats in calling for a withdrawal.
Well, it's somewhat ironic, is it not, that we've been hearing a lot of talk for months now about getting the Iraqi parties to agree with each other, and now you see these divisions appearing within the administration?
Yes, it is, and it's a sign of how upset people are about this. There's a lot of anger at the Iraqi government for not coming to terms more quickly with some of the political choices that have to be made, and a sense of frustration, I think, within the administration that here they are finally hopefully getting what they want from the security situation, but the politics are still in chaos in Iraq, and they're in some ways even worse here because people are turning against this war. They're sick of hearing things that haven't come true from the administration. I think the president has very little credibility left with Democrats and even many Republicans who've turned on him at this point.
Along those same lines, let's listen to some tape from the Marine Corps Association appearance yesterday by Secretary Gates.
Every evening, I write notes to the families of young Americans like Doug Zimbiak. For you and for me, they are not names on a press release or numbers updated on a website. They are a country's sons and daughters.
Wow, Rick. That is Defense Secretary Robert Gates speaking about a Marine killed in Iraq. Such emotionalism, it's stunning coming from within the administration.
It is. My first thought was that was the kind of thing we'd never hear or see from Secretary Rumsfeld, his predecessor in that job. But it's clear that this is taking a toll on a lot of people who are involved in this. And the president has talked about the personal angst and anguish he's had in talking to the families of victims, something he's done on a regular basis, although pretty quietly. This was pretty dramatic video to see the Secretary of Defense break down in front of all these people talking about this. No one's questioning that this has taken a toll on these folks, of course, but I think a lot of Democrats say, well, you know, I think it's clear that there needs to be a change in course and that Americans are losing their lives for a lost cause.
Rick Klein is senior news analyst for ABC News. He writes the note for the network's website. Rick, thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Whether it's karma or the hand of God or the truculence that is Barry Bonds, the event which most of baseball wants to be done with has been torturously slow in coming. But after hitting two home runs yesterday, Barry Bonds needs only two more to tie and three to break the Major League record. You may remember the moment when Hank Aaron eclipsed Babe Ruth back in 1974.
The pitch by Downing. Swinging. There's a drive into left center field. That ball is going to be out of here. It's gone. It's 7-15.
It seems likely there'll be no such joy when Barry Bonds breaks Aaron's record. The rumors and scandals of steroids and human growth hormone continue to cling to Bonds. In the past, what's pulled baseball out of scandal has been the home run, starting with the Babe. Like its nation, the national pastime often turns to brute force in crisis, writes Robert Lipsight. This time he says the home run won't work. Indeed, he wants it banned. The distinguished former reporter and columnist for the New York Times, Robert Lipsight, joins us to talk about his recent essay, How We Learn to Start Worrying and Hate the Bomb, Mickey Mantle, Barry Bonds, and the Bad Boys of Summer. Welcome, Robert.
Hi, Dave.
Well, we're going to get at your radical prescription soon enough. But first, you were there, and you write that the home run, or at least home run fever, pulled baseball out of two crises, the Black Sox scandal, and then later on the baseball strike of 1994. Yes?
Yeah.
Tell me why home runs and home run fever pulled baseball out of those crises.
Well, I mean, the sheer excitement of it, one, pulled baseball out of its kind of biggest crisis, which was in 1919 after the Chicago White Sox, the so-called Black Sox, fixed the World Series. And then along came Babe Ruth and started hitting those powerful home runs. And immediately, baseball was exciting again, and exciting in a very different way. I mean, up until that time, baseball had performed what we now call small ball, the hit and run, the steal, you know, the clever little strategies. But now, all of a sudden, and much the way America had won World War One with the Big Bang, you know, the powerful guns, the bombs, here was American power once again. So many years later, after 1994, after strikes, after kind of a malaise had set in, football, basketball, NASCAR was on the horizon, baseball was in a slump, and we had that summer of 98 where two guys who we now suspect were pretty well juiced themselves, Sam Sosa and Mark McGwire, had that wonderful home run derby. Which once again excited us.
It seemed innocent at the time. We celebrated that season.
I don't think so, Dave. I don't think we can ever claim innocence. And I for one, as a longtime sports writer, do not claim innocence. I look back at stupidity. I remember in the 70s going into locker rooms, pro football, even some baseball, certainly Olympic locker rooms, and wondering why all these, you know, guys who had suddenly sprouted these huge arms and shoulders had pimples all over their backs. I said, well, must be, you know, the equipment rubbing. How much did I know?
So,
but, you know, more sophisticated sports writers should have figured out that something was going on. So I think we didn't want to know. And by the way, I think we still don't want to know.
You say that there is a cost, and that's the cost of the home run saving baseball in 1919 and then in 1998.
Well, I think we lost the soul of baseball, which was strategy, which was interesting, which was the game itself. And I think in many ways it pervades the entire culture. You know, it's kind of the attitude of the lottery, of something's going to fall off the back of a truck for us. Something is good going to happen. We're not going to have to work too hard. You know, our ass is going to get saved somehow, in some way. And that's the sensibility of the home run.
The cost of Babe Ruth, you say, goes beyond that in that he set the mold for the American sports personality, yes?
Oh, I think, yes, he did that as well. I mean, there's a very clear line of this kind of rowdy, totally self-absorbed jock who we kind of, you know, worship until he embarrasses us, and then we kind of get rid of him. I mean, it's really too bad that Barry Bonds has such a lousy personality. I mean, which is really what most of this is about. I've interviewed him. He's terrible. I mean, he's just so cranky.
Much different personality than Hank Aaron, whose record
he didn't have
he's
much
breaking.
Of a personality.
You say, quite frankly, which is interesting, that Hank Aaron didn't have much personality. People
nah.
didn't think much of him until that season.
Yeah, he was you know, an okay guy. He was not difficult. He was really an honest workman, you know, and I think he was really a great ball player.
You write, though, that it was Mickey Mantle who didn't come close enough. He was the chosen one.
Right. I mean, he was the guy that everybody wanted. If anybody was going to break the Babe's record, and I think we were ready for that.
And yet, your comparison of Bonds and Mantle, at least on one score, makes Barry Bonds seem far more virtuous.
Well,
never
no,
drank,
I mean,
did he? He never drank.
Yeah,
or
he
was certain he was not.
Comparisons are probably invidious, but yeah, I mean, as far as
he worked harder than anyone else. You write about Barry exercising
right.
And weightlifting obsessively.
I don't want to defend his steroid use, if indeed he used steroids, which we tend to believe. But you know, it's not like he was snorting coke for his personal pleasure. He was trying to get better. He was trying to, you know, build more strength. So he was really trying hard.
Whereas you write, the fact is this, Mantle did not give the game and us his best, yet he has become
right.
emblematic
yeah.
of our baseball dreams.
Yeah, he was hungover most of the time. He was drunk. He did not work hard at repairing injury. He didn't work out during the off season.
I think you make the point here, really subtly, that alcoholism may be the accepted form of medical abuse in baseball.
Yes, I do think that the boys do medicate. Between alcohol and amphetamines has been the major drugs.
We'll be right back with Robert Lipside hitting the fences with his long ball prescription for baseball here and now. I'm David Boeri. It's Here and Now, and we're speaking with Robert Lipside, distinguished former sports reporter and columnist for the New York Times, and author of a recent essay that describes the home run as the mark of the beast, veritably the brute force emblematic of baseball and militarism. His essay, appearing on the website tomdispatch.com, is titled How We Learn to Start Worrying and Hate the Bomb, Mickey Mantle, Barry Bonds, and the Bad Boys of Summer. And okay, now let's get to the big picture, Robert Lipside, the meta-analysis here. You write that by the time you became a fan of the 1940s, a homer could suddenly turn the tide of a taut pitcher's battle, just as a mega bomb could end a war. Duck in cover. This one is going, gone. What was the Cold War if it wasn't about two powerhouse sluggers waving big bats that could clear the bases forever? Let me ask you the question you pose. Will banning the home run lead to banning the bomb?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's certainly a provocative thought that if we didn't have these weapons of mass destruction, would we be more likely to try to, you know, negotiate, to to work things out, to use diplomacy, you know, to talk, rather than trying to intimidate and scare each other with this idea of, you know, deterrence are going to keep everything at bay. And now we know that there are some real nut jobs out there who don't operate under that code. So the idea that, yeah, I think that there is a parallel there between those two big bangs.
So if in fact baseball has become synonymous with American military and foreign policy, you say the simple fix for baseball is to make any ball hit out of the park an automatic out.
I got mail that leads me to think that maybe instead of an automatic out, it should be a ground rule double. So I'm willing to compromise too.
Okay, so a ground rule double, just like when the ball bounces over the wall. But what about the inside the park home run? Are you against that too?
I'm not against the home run per se. I'm against the clout that goes out of the ballpark, that big smash. I think that if a runner is so fast and clever that he can score an inside the park home run, well, I think that's great. I mean, I wouldn't dare say this, but you know, maybe that should get like two runs. But no. I think that the inside the park homer is great. I mean, then we're talking about speed and we're talking about base running skill.
And when you ban the bomb, the use of the juice will drop, you're predicting?
I think so. I mean, I think that's, you know, I don't believe that you can really ban steroids. I don't think ball players are using steroids anymore. I think they're probably on to much more sophisticated drugs, human growth hormone, other things created by, you know, boutique scientists that cannot be found. If we were really serious about steroid use in this country, we would forget about the major leagues. We would put all our effort into making sure that middle school and high school athletes, which is really where the issue is, are not using those drugs. These are the kids that are vulnerable and need to be saved. I don't think that high school kids, you know, take steroids because Barry Bonds is taking steroids. They're taking it because the kid 1 year ahead of them gained 30 pounds over a summer and got a Division I scholarship, and they realize that the stuff really works. Well, I think they have to be saved from using that stuff at a time when there can be real neurological and physical and emotional damage. I don't think that a Barry Bonds can hurt himself or us anymore.
Robert Lipsight, let's hear Mark McGwire sending one up right now. Robert Lipsight, honestly, can a hit and run like I saw the other night when the Cubs beat the Giants compete with that?
Well, if you really care about baseball, yeah. I mean, I think that if you're a very serious baseball fan, you don't leave a 1-0 game saying nothing happened. You say, wow, that was really great baseball. Mm. You know, if you're not a real baseball fan and you're waiting for that big smash, I think you should go watch old Arnold Schwarzenegger movies.
I have to tell you, I was watching that game on ESPN. Giants up 2-1. It's the last inning. Cubs behind, man on first. Lou Piniella calls for the hit and run. It was beautiful. Batter puts that ball, which would have been just right to the second baseman, would have been a great double play. Instead, second baseman goes over to cover second. The ball goes through. You have runners on first and second. Next guy gets a hit, brings in two runs, and only they tie, they win. Not one newspaper referred to it the next day.
Really?
Yeah, the hit and run. Not one paper. It was
those are the guys who don't think that everybody's taking steroids. It has been for the last 20 years.
So the home run, plus or minus, you say, looking back at all that history, relatively speaking, it's been the minus.
I don't think it's taken us in any good place. I mean, also, politically, where you think about where we are right now or where baseball is right now, I don't think that the big bomb, whether it's a killing bomb or a home run, is something that has advanced civilization in any way. Not in any way that, you know, intelligence and strategy and diplomacy and that hit and run. will take us.
Robert Lipsight, former sports reporter, former sports columnist for the New York Times, distinguished novelist, baseball fan, and now ban the bomb advocate. Thanks for joining us, Robert.
David, thank you, and keep swinging.
To read Robert Lipsight's column, go to our website, here-now.org. And while you're there, download a podcast and take us with you wherever you're gone. Next week on Here and Now, the delicate balance of relations between the U.S. and Iran. Also, the story of three teenagers who will be tried as adults in a horrific sexual assault case in West Palm Beach, Florida. That's next week. Still ahead today, the story of newborns infected by HIV-tainted blood transfusions in the early days of the AIDS epidemic. Here and now. I'm David Boeri, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A story in the Los Angeles Times caught our attention recently. It's called The Forgotten Ones, about the dozens of children infected by HIV-tainted blood transfusions at a major L.A. hospital in the early days of the AIDS epidemic, when the disease didn't even have a name. A survivor and a father of a victim are now raising questions about actions taken and not taken by officials at Cedars-Sinai Hospital, one of the most renowned medical facilities in the country. Joining us is Los Angeles Times staff writer Charles Ornstein, who wrote the article, which appeared in Sunday's newspaper. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, thanks for having me on the program.
Absolutely. Tell us, how'd you come across this story?
I've been talking to Alex Ghaffari and Bruce Casper for a couple of years now.
Alexander Ghaffari is the survivor, and Bruce Casper is the father of a victim, if I understand
correctly. That's correct.
So tell us first about Alexander Ghaffari.
Alex Ghaffari was born in 1982 at Cedars-Sinai. He was born prematurely, and he needed emergency surgery after his birth. And during the course of the surgery, he received a blood transfusion. And he went home, and he was seemingly okay. And about 5 years later, his family received a phone call from Cedars-Sinai that he had received a blood transfusion, and he needed to be tested for the HIV virus, and he was positive.
So, well, he doesn't find out until the age of 16 from his mother that he's positive.
Right. Actually, it's really surprising that a lot of children who were infected, their parents kept it a secret from the children, and they kept it a secret from their family, from their friends. There was a fear to tell anybody that your child was infected. Otherwise, you could be seen as a pariah.
How many other newborns were infected at Cedars-Sinai?
Well, we know this, that at least 33 newborns were infected at Cedars-Sinai, and they weren't able to reach hundreds of additional people, or those folks weren't willing to participate.
So, to be clear, this wasn't the only hospital where people were infected by the HIV-tainted blood transfusions.
You're right. I mean, it's very easy to think now, in 2007, to look back and say, geez, you know, we have really great methods of testing blood, we have a test for HIV, but back then, there wasn't a test for HIV. And so those that were donating in those very early years, there was no method to screen them out. There's some debate about how aggressively the blood banks and blood transfusion community responded and whether they were vigorous enough and acted quickly enough to protect patients. But there wasn't a test for HIV until 1985. That is not in dispute.
Let's take a look at the timeline. It's 1980 that some of these children first appear. They have the transfusions. If I'm not mistaken, it's 1983 when the first child dies of AIDS-related pneumonia, and that's when they determine that it's tainted blood. Now, when does Cedars-Sinai notify parents that they should have these children that had transfusions as babies checked out?
Well, Cedars-Sinai told us that they notified all families in 1987 as part of a broad study, but they would notify families earlier if there was, you know, a definitive link between a donor to their child and a diagnosis of AIDS. So if somebody had come forward with AIDS in those early years and had given blood, they would notify selected families that their children had received blood. But the first broad-scale notification didn't happen until 1987.
So that's 4 years later.
And that's what the the older man in our story, Bruce Casper, was so frustrated about. His daughter was born in 1980 and received blood transfusions at Cedars-Sinai. And three other people who had received blood from Anique's donor, the little girl's donor, had been diagnosed with AIDS in 1983, 1984, and 1985, and yet Bruce Casper indicates that he wasn't notified until February of 1987. And to him, that's an unconscionable delay in notification.
And yet the hospital, in its defense, says, we didn't know, we only knew that there might be a chance, but not that it was.
That's right. And the hospital also, you know, made clear that in some cases, children would receive blood from dozens of donors. And back in those days, blood donor cards were kept on paper in banker's boxes. They weren't on computer.
Now, Charlie, it seems, I'm going to make a guess, and I don't mean to be unfair. It seems, reading this story, that you pursued this as an investigative piece that ultimately came to, not to a dead end for you, but came to a point where you couldn't show or demonstrate convincingly the culpability of the hospital. Am I mistaken?
Well, I think we were looking at this from the perspective of what could the hospital have known at the time. What should they have known? What was their responsibility to tell patients? But ultimately, what struck me as the most important part of the story are two things. One, the fact that some of the children who were infected 25 years ago are still living today, and some of those children are struggling for answers.
Mm.
And the second point is just the immense amount of pain and suffering that the families of people who were infected, whose children passed away, what they're going through, and how this isn't something that when a child passes away, it just goes away. That for these families, it's something that they continue to deal with to this day.
That's clear. Their pain is clear. What about the hospital, though? What can they reasonably be accused of having failed at here?
That's the tougher question. Certainly, Bruce and Alex think the hospital has done a lot wrong.
They say the documents are missing.
Destroyed. There aren't documents. Alex's medical records have been misplaced from his childhood. Bruce's lawsuit was dismissed by a judge. What Alex and Bruce are arguing is that there's some sort of a moral responsibility that they've failed to heed. And I think our perspective was, you know, we want to present all sides of this and explain the complexities of that time to deal with tainted blood. It's not a pretty story all around.
Cedars-Sinai is has provided free care to those who have taken them up on their offer.
They provide basically the agree to waive insurance co-payments. So they accept as payment what the insurance companies pay. So it's not quite free, but they have done more than other hospitals around the country have.
Mm. Alex Ghaffari is accepting free care. He's now grown resistant to nearly all of the AIDS drugs on the market, you write.
Mm-hmm.
What's the future hold for him?
Alex is now in an experimental trial with an experimental medication, and his numbers are improving. He's leading a fairly healthy life. He's hoping to write a screenplay based on his experience, and more than anything, I think he hopes to remind society that children who were infected are still around and that they don't want to be forgotten, and that they do hope that society is aware of this and maybe even provide some sort of a compensation for these children who were infected.
What is the risk of receiving HIV-tainted blood today?
The risk is extraordinarily minute. According to the American Red Cross, the chances of receiving HIV through a blood transfusion are about 1 in 1.5 million.
Mm. Charles Ornstein is a staff writer for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks for joining us, Charlie.
Thanks for having me.
Just a reminder, you can hear our show anytime on our website, here-now.org. All our past programs are there, too, in our archives. You can also download a podcast of our broadcast and take us with you wherever you go. That's here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. Only hours stand between us and the midnight release of the last book in the Harry Potter series, and the wall to defend against plot spoilers has been breached by the early shipment of some 1,200 copies of the book in the U.S., which enabled two newspapers, including the New York Times, to publish early reviews. But Harry Potter parties will rev up around the world as readers line up to buy their copies. Harvard Square here in Cambridge, Massachusetts, has been dubbed Hogwarts Square, with the band Harry and the Potters playing for the expected masses. 5 years ago, Paul and Joe DeGeorge of nearby Norwood started the band, billing themselves as Harry from year 7 and year 4, and thereby launched the wave known as Wizard Rock. And wave it is, some 200 bands calling themselves Draco and the Malfoys, the Whomping Willows, and Ministry of Magic, among others. Paul, the lead Potter in the Two Brothers Act, joins us now. Welcome, Wizard.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start, Paul, by listening to some music. This is Save Ginny Weasley, the lyrics here referring to HP and the Chamber of Secrets.
We've got to save Ginny Weasley from the basilisk. We've got to save the school from that unseen horror. We've got to
Okay, Paul, there's no way around this first question. Your music has been called sloppy, the sound quality lame, and that's from a positive review. Paul DeGeorge, how would you rate your musicianship?
Well, honestly, we recorded that song 4 years ago in our parents' living room, and we had no idea what we were doing, you know?
Have you gotten better?
We've gotten a lot better. I'm totally serious. We had no idea what we were doing, and we had no idea so many people would be interested in what we were doing. And maybe the musicianship is not totally up to par, but I think that's what rock and roll is all about, you know? It's not about being the most technically proficient. It's about having a passion for what you do.
Well, Paul, technical proficiency aside, one defense for your musicianship, I guess, is that it does promote and encourage literacy. And
sure.
If you clearly play your own instruments, you also write your own lyrics.
Yeah, absolutely.
Harry Potter fans are fanatical about the details and the correct details. How faithful are you to those books when you write your lyrics?
Oh, we're absolutely canonical. You know, we stay way, way in character with it. People generally seem to really appreciate that, you know. They really go for the obscure minutia.
Faithful to the lyrics, and those fans are faithful to the books. You have a concert tonight, Harvard Square, comes before the midnight release of the final book. 10,000-20,000 fans are expected. Honestly, Paul, aren't you and your brother like a pair of skateboarders who've kind of grabbed onto the fender of a passing car here that's speeding to the bank?
In some ways, for sure. I mean, that's what drew us to Harry Potter, you know? The whole reason I got involved was because I was really curious about what was so inspiring about these books, you know, what was getting these kids so interested in reading and why they were so captivated by these books. And honestly, when we started our band, we thought, well, people are so into these books, maybe we can use them as a gateway to get them involved in music.
And it's a gateway to the bank for you, too, isn't it, by riding that wave?
Well, we're doing all right. You know, we're able to tour around on our own, unsupported by any sort of record label and that sort of thing. So, you know, it's good. It's a great way to spend your summer.
What happens after the last book is published?
Honestly, we haven't made any plans beyond this summer. We never approached it as a sort of long-term thing. We always saw the release of the seventh book as a sort of like goal for us, and we always wanted to play a big show in our hometown, and that's what we're doing.
Is there something, Paul, you'd like to close on from your canon of Wizard Rock?
I would probably like you to play This Book Is So Awesome. It's definitely our most meta song. It speaks to both everyone's love of books and also a specific incident in the sixth book where Harry finds this great potions book that's been modified to help him out in potions class.
So we close with This Book Is So Awesome, the meta song from the meta band of Wizard Rock, Harry and the Potters. Paul DeGeorge, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks so much for having me. Hopefully we'll see you tonight in Harvard Square.
Can you hear me, Professor Snape? I can make anything. This book is so awesome.
Just ahead, former Wall Street Journal reporter Nick Kulish has a novel about a gossip columnist embedded in Iraq. I'm David Boeri. It's Here and Now. In an age when real-time coverage of Paris Hilton's trials and Lindsay Lohan's sobriety run in heavy rotation on CNN, celebrity muckraking is big news. Enter Jimmy Stevens, a hapless, bottom-feeding reporter for a New York tabloid. One night, in the bathroom of a fashionable sushi restaurant, he sees four legs in a stall and thinks he's hit the motherlode of celebrity scandals. He's wrong, and about to be fired when a real reporter with the same name and precious credentials to embed in Iraq is run over by a delivery truck. Jimmy Stevens' only chance to keep his job, his designer suits, and his expense accounts is on the tip of the Marine spearhead into Iraq in 2003. In the world of nonfiction, Nicholas Coolish was an embedded reporter with the Marines for The Wall Street Journal in 2003. He's the author of Last One In, a satirical novel set in Iraq. Welcome, Nicholas Coolish.
Thanks very much.
Nicholas, Iraq spring 2003 was certainly different than Iraq summer 2007. Those first weeks, it was a cakewalk. It was a conventional war. American media had flags and their medals, and Saddam was toppled in the square. Now, nobody could call this cake or comic. But here comes your book. Would you have ever written that book if you'd been there last spring?
No, you would have to write a completely different book from this one. I mean, I think that this is about not the Iraq War, but about the Iraq invasion, about this one incredibly optimistic period where there wasn't a lot of second guessing and saying, what will happen if we topple this country? How will things go in year four? Everything was measured in days, in weeks, and in months. And the then what is the big question that we've been trying to answer ever since.
Mm. With all the deaths and dismemberments of Americans, Iraqis, and of course, of reporters too, is it too soon to treat this war as material for satire?
I don't think that it is. I think that it would be too soon to treat it as comedy, and probably never should be. But this is a very serious book that just happens to have a lot of the nervous and gallows humor that is natural to these situations, and I think true to what was going on there.
You have a real sense for dialogue.
Thanks a lot.
Is this close to what you heard?
It's close to what I heard. It seems, I've had to apologize to my mother. It seems packed with profanity, but actually there were probably three or four times as many curse words per sentence than I left in here. But yeah, I think that there's a rhythm and there's a tone and there's a style to the way that the Marines talk, and I felt like that came through on the page when I wrote it.
Jimmy's a screw-up. He's hazed by the Marines. They dislike him. But he comes to like them and realize they were terrified. Did you have an experience that told you how scared these guys were when you were with them?
I think that they express their fear very differently. You need to have a certain amount of confidence in order to be ready, to fight. And there's also a great deal of bravado that's necessary so that sort of if everybody sits around, you know, talking about the bad things that are going to happen, then nobody can do the mission. But there was at one point I was embedded with a helicopter squadron, and one of the guys went missing. Somebody who was fortunately found. And at that moment, when people realized, hey, you know, he's gone, maybe he's not coming back, you know, suddenly you could see in their eyes that this got to them, that they weren't these impervious, you know, invulnerable fighting machines, but that they were real guys who were worried about their friends.
And that's when they get on their knees and open their Bibles.
Well, you know, everybody's different, but yeah, the Bible was definitely somewhere they turned to. It was funny because they handed out Bibles, and they were Gideon Bibles, just like you would find in a hotel. But they were tiny, like they could fit in the palm of your hand, and they had a little index in them saying, you know, fear, turn to page 73 and read this passage. It was pretty funny.
The book certainly works as satire when you're telling us about the inept Jimmy parroting the lines of the government and army flax. Set the scene for us, Nick.
There was this strange moment when the American government started referring to the anti-Iraqi forces. And there's a scene with a young man who's working for the Coalition Provisional Authority speaking to Jimmy. No one is claiming this is paradise yet. As the colonel said, we'll have to degrade and disrupt the anti-Iraqi forces. Who? Jimmy asked. The anti-Iraqi forces, the real problem facing this country, Brett said, taking a hit from the water bottle. We are, Jimmy said. This was a pretty radical statement, Maybe Brett's jet lag was worse than either of them thought. "They are," Brett said. "Who?" "The anti-Iraqi forces." "I thought we were fighting Iraq," Jimmy said. "We liberated Iraq," Brett corrected. "So," Jimmy said slowly, "we're the pro-Iraqi forces, and the anti-Iraqi forces are the Iraqis." "Exactly," Brett said.
No one gets off easy here. You extend the satire to the self-styled war correspondents like MTV and National Geographic.
Yeah, well, it was strange in a way. It felt like everybody had to have an embed.
And you have the TV reporter who scruffs up before getting in front of the camera to look more embattled.
Yeah, exactly. There's a character named Woody, the vain television correspondent. And there's this difficult line that you have to try to follow in this case where you don't want to look bad, but you also want to look a little battle-hardened. So maybe a few streaks of oil and tousled hair are good, but just dirty would be bad.
Of course, this was before the car bombs and the suicide bombers showed up and started killing reporters.
Some reporters did die during the invasion. Michael Kelly springs to mind. There were several other. So, I mean, it's not as though the invasion itself was in any way, you know, a light undertaking, but it's nothing like the paralyzing violence that Baghdad and much of Iraq experiences today.
Jimmy Stevens is there. It's not going to be a surprise to anybody. We know that he's going to redeem himself. From page one, we know he's going to redeem himself after what he saw in the bathroom and fear of losing his job. Without giving much away, we also know about the real war.
Yeah.
Things turn deadlier.
Absolutely. And I think that's part of the inherent seriousness of the book, that what happened in Iraq, you know, started out relatively quick and clean and has slowly become deadlier and more dangerous for all of our troops.
Would you jump to embed again?
It would depend a lot on the circumstances, I think. I really enjoyed being with the Marine Corps. I think you might notice reading the book that my regard for these guys is almost limitless. You spend a couple months with them and you just think, these are the kind of service-minded people, men and women, that this country needs.
You think those Marines are the same as these Marines, though?
The Marines that I served with?
Are the same as today's Marines 4 years later?
You know, I think that the people are the same. I think that probably the way that they feel, and I can't speak for them, but the way that they feel about being there has to be different, because there was such a clear goal. There was such a clear mission at the beginning. And now I think that, you know, it's a little more of a slog.
Nicholas Kulish is now an editor for the New York Times. For more on his new book, Last One In, visit our website, here-now.org. Thanks for joining us, Nicholas.
Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, and Alex Ashluck and Virginia Prescott. Doug Shugarts is our engineer. Our web producer is Ken George. Our interns are Chris Cuff, Ben Singer, Emily Mahoney, and Emily Reddy. Our managing editor is Chris Ballman. And the senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm David Boeri. Have a home run of a weekend, with or without Harry and Barry. And join us again Monday on Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio Internet.